Right. I gave this talk, the first time I gave this talk was a couple of weeks ago to the U3A in Weymouth, and it went on for an hour and a half. I would like to say that I've taken quite a few slides out. And I will not be talking about why quasars are interstellar spacecraft, which is right at the end. Right, I've put out on the table up there quite a few books, which you're welcome to browse, and I've opened the pages which I'll be referring to. I've also got some handouts from New Scientist with an article I published back in 1990, which you can help yourself to. So just have a browse at the table up there. So Quirky Astronomy, this is going to be my first commercially published book. So I've published all the other books myself, but an American publisher has taken this on. But this whole talk was inspired really by a book that I bought in 1972 by Patrick Moore called Can You Speak Venusian? And there is a copy up there if you want to have a browse. This was followed up by a television programme, a 40-minute television programme, where he goes around talking to all these rather eccentric people who believe that the current view of the universe and the planets is all wrong and that they have a theory which fits the facts very much better. And that sort of inspired me to eventually come up with this talk and the book, which I say is going to be published in April. Right, so I'm going to talk about funny ideas in astronomy and also funny people as well. And you may be intrigued by this picture of life on the moon as observed in 1835. I'll come back to that later when we get to the moon. But I'm going to start off by, there's the book, Patrick Moore's book, and it's still available on Amazon, incidentally. Thoroughly recommend it. Absolutely funny book, it really is. I'm going to start talking about some of the unusual people in astronomy, and you've probably all heard of Tycho Brahe, one of the great astronomers of the pre-telescopic age. He died in 1601, and Marius and Galileo did their observations of the skies and discovered the moons of Jupiter, for example, with the very first telescopes that were pointed at the skies, and that was about 5 years after Tycho died. But Tycho was a very enthusiastic astronomer. He was also a very enthusiastic boozer. He loved having parties. He had a curious childhood because at the age of two, he was stolen from his parents by an uncle, but the parents just shrugged and didn't seem to bother about this. One of the reasons for this was that the uncle was one of the richest people in Denmark. And in fact, when Tycho Brahe was aged about 20, it is estimated that he was not only the richest person in Denmark, but he actually, his assets were about 1% of the total Danish GDP at the time. So he was extremely wealthy, and therefore he could go off and study the heavens as much as he liked. At the age of 20, he had his nose sliced off because he got in a duel with a student at university about how to solve a mathematical theorem. I don't think these days any mathematicians would quite go that far. But for the whole of his life after that, he had to wear a prosthetic nose. His body was exhumed in about 1910 and again in 2006, I think it was, to prove that he did have a prosthetic nose. And sure enough, one of the noses was in the tomb with him. It seems he wore a bronze nose every day, but if he was going to a special audience with the king, he would put on a gold or silver nose. He had a pet elk, which he absolutely loved. I mean, some people love cats, others love dogs. He loved this elk. The elk went everywhere with him, and it had the free run of his castle. He had a huge castle built on a little island called Hvin, which is between Sweden and Denmark. Unfortunately, the pet elk was lent out to a friend of his, who was at a rowdy party one day, and the elk got stone drunk, fell down the stairs, broke its neck and died. So, you're supposed to go, ah. He died of a burst bladder at a royal banquet. This must have been extremely painful. He was at this royal banquet, the king was sitting there, and protocol said that nobody must rise from their seats until the king rose. So there's Tycho Brahe, who was guzzling down his ale, and then he suddenly realised he shouldn't quite have been drinking quite so much because the king looked as if he was just sipping water up the other end of the table. And he was getting worse and worse and worse. And by the end of the banquet, by the time the king actually rose, it was too late. His bladder had literally split and he could do nothing about it. He got an infection and 2 weeks later he actually died. There was a rumour that in fact he was poisoned because he was pretty well known to have been bedding the queen at the time, and you can imagine the king was not very happy about this, and there was a story that the king had sent out some of his secret agents to actually poison Tycho Brahe, and this is one other reason why they exhumed his body, and they found no sign of poisoning, but they did find he had a burst bladder. Shakespeare seems to have based the play Hamlet on Tycho Brahe's life. There's a lot of evidence for this. Not only do the characters in Tycho Brahe's life tie up with the characters in Hamlet, but if you look in this picture, and I was saying to somebody just up the back there, isn't it terrible these days when people put slides up but you can't read? But around the portrait of Tycho Brahe are a lot of his relatives. They're shields, so I've blown them up so that you can read them. And these are two. There's Rosencrantz and there's Guildenstern. Now, if you know your Hamlet, you'll know that there are two characters in Hamlet called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and they were spies who didn't last long, like almost everybody in Hamlet. They finished up dead. But it's just curious, isn't it? It's too much of a coincidence that Hamlet would have introduced two characters with those names, Guildenstern and Rosencrantz, which are actually relatives of Tycho Brahe. So the evidence is actually compelling that Tycho Brahe's life was the subject of Hamlet. This is his observatory, which he had built, and you can see from this that he was immensely wealthy. It was also a government-funded research institute, and at one time he had over 100 students there in the late 1580s. And it's actually known now that this was the first government-funded scientific research establishment ever built in the world. So there was a lot going on in Tycho's time. George Ellery Hale is another character, much more modern character. He was the driving force behind building this huge telescope on the top of Mount Palomar. And I'm sure you've all heard of the 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope. It was built during the late 1930s, 1940s, and it was first commissioned in 1949. It was way ahead of its time. No other telescope had been designed like this. But George Ellery Hale, who in my new book, the editors have decided to call a brainiac. Terrible. What is a brainiac, for goodness sake? Anyway, he was a rather odd character. He was very persuasive. He managed to persuade Carnegie, the Scottish-American steel magnate, to actually provide nearly all of the money to build this telescope. And nearly all of the telescopes, incidentally, in America, the big telescopes, like the Keck telescopes and so on in Hawaii, are privately funded, which is quite surprising. We don't do that in this country. But he was a rather odd character. In the 1930s, he lived in Pasadena, and he had a three-wheeled motorbike built, which could go at an enormous speed. And he used to enjoy out chasing the police. The police would chase him all the way around Pasadena, and he'd sort of, you know, wave two fingers at them, or what the American equivalent is. But he was also a very troubled man. And when he had problems and he couldn't get the money for the telescope and things like that, an elf would materialise and start giving him advice. And he'd sit there and talk to him, and he'd talk to this elf. And this went on for his whole life. And I sometimes wonder in this country if that would be a very cheap way of getting sort of mental health advice. We could call it the National Elf Service, couldn't we? It doesn't get any better. Right, let's go back to 1787. What I'm going to do now is to work out from through the solar system, from the sun, going out to the planets and going out into the universe. There was a certain Dr. Eliot who murdered his lover in 1787, and he was taken to court, charged with murder, for which he was going to be strung up on the gallows if found guilty. But a friend of his said, no, you can't do that. He's completely mad. And I've got the evidence. He wrote me this letter. And this letter was read out in court. He said, the sun is not a body of fire, as has been hitherto supposed, but that its light proceeds from a dense and universal aurora, which may afford ample light to the inhabitants of the surface beneath. He thought the sun was inhabited, and yet be at such a distance aloft as to not annoy them. So he said, yeah, there's people living inside the sun, but all these bright clouds above them shine out, but they don't shine down. So vegetation may obtain there as well as us. As well as with us, there may be water and dry land, hills and dales, rain and fair weather. And as for light, so the seasons must be eternal. Consequently, it must easily be conceived to be by far the most blissful habitation in the whole of the solar system. And the judge read this and said, he's completely mad. So they changed the charge from murder to manslaughter, and he was sent to prison instead. He believed that the sun was inhabited. Okay, this appeared in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, which is as far up the scientific tree as you can get. Very, very serious. I have shown that we have reason to look upon the sun as a most magnificent habitable globe. The sun is a cool, dark, solid globe, clothed in luxuriant vegetation and richly stored with inhabitants. Wow, that was published in the Transactions of the Royal Society. And who wrote that? Sir William Herschel. Sir William Herschel, probably the greatest astronomer that ever lived, certainly the greatest British astronomer, discovered the planet Uranus. He was the first one to plot out the shape of the galaxy and realise that we were in a huge spiral collection of stars. He was a genius, and yet he believed that the sun was inhabited. Absolutely amazing. And so did the astronomer royal, John Flamsteed. He believed that the sun was inhabited. In fact, they all believed that all the planets were inhabited, including the moon and the sun. The astronomer royal, John Flamsteed, agreed with Herschel that the sun was probably inhabited with aliens living inside a cool inner sphere. Right, this is a picture of a large sunspot. A lot of people believed, certainly in the 1800s, that you could look into the sunspot, where this black spot is here, and you could look into there with a powerful enough telescope, and you would see the inner world inside the sun. And some people had claimed when they looked down here, they were looking through a hole, and they would see vegetation and creatures moving around inside the sun on a dark, cold body. I also make you draw your attention to this round the other side. All this bright stuff here is what the actual surface of the sun looks like outside the sunspots. And it looks like grains of rice, doesn't it? That is granulation. It's called granulation. And what it is, it's convection cells. There's vast heat coming up from the inside of the sun. The centre of the sun is about 15 million degrees centigrade. This is all welling up. And this heat comes up and boils up on the surface and forms these convection cells up there. And these were observed by astronomers in the 1700s and 1800s. And this is a drawing by James Naismith in the 1850s, actually. But you see, it's totally wrong. Drawn them rather like, they're described as willow leaves, but they're not. They don't look anything like that. But Sir William Herschel believed that these were organisms living on the sun's surface. Despite the fact that the sun appears to be roaring hot, 5,500 degrees centigrade, we now know the surface of the sun, despite that, he and a lot of people believe that these granulations were actually living creatures moving around. And there's another picture, another mid-Victorian picture of solar granulation. It looks quite different to the previous picture, which just goes to show how difficult it was to observe these effects. And they believe that these were individual creatures, all moving and writhing around on the surface, following each other like a sort of snake-like pattern. In modern times, people have believed that the sun is cold. There's a book up there, a blue book, called The Temperate Sun, by the Dr. Reverend Francis. He's a doctor of mathematics at Oxford University, so he's no fool. And he believed, certainly in 1962, that the sun was cold. And if you go and see this new YouTube video, which I've got a reference to up there, of Patrick Moore's little talk, 40-minute talk to these people, you see him interviewing the Reverend Francis, and Reverend Francis is sitting there with his dog collar on. He was a reverend, he's definitely a reverend, and he was explaining why he thinks the sun is cold. And the book is actually quite interesting. You can browse through it. It's up on the table there, the blue-covered book. And he talks about all sorts of things. He explains the energy cycle of the Earth, how the sun heats the Earth. It doesn't do it by the conventional way. The silvering of heavenly bodies. He believed that the moon covered in a silvery glow. That's why it was glowing. It wasn't being lit up by the sun at all. He also has hot ages and ice ages, and the reversal of ice ages. He believed his theory explained the existence of ice ages. And I'm not going to go into the detail. If you want to know about it, buy the book. I think it's probably still available. One of his arguments was, heat cannot travel through a vacuum. If it did, they wouldn't make vacuum flasks. So you put your hot coffee in the vacuum flask in the morning and it's still hot in the afternoon. Why? Because it's one container inside another and there's a vacuum. So heat doesn't travel through a vacuum. And yet the sun, it is claimed, is 93 million miles away and the space between the sun and the Earth is a complete vacuum. So therefore the heat cannot be coming from the sun and warming the Earth. There must be something coming from the sun which actually stimulates the Earth to produce the heat. So the heat is being created on the Earth and not on the sun, because it just can't get across that vacuum. He believed that the sun is greatly electrically charged, a huge positive charge on it, and it's these electrical rays which can travel through the vacuum which are stimulating heat to be generated on the Earth. He said that almost the electrical charge on the sun is almost so great that you could get a huge flash of lightning, a huge bolt of lightning between the sun and the Earth, although luckily this has never been observed, but if it ever happened, that would be the end of the Earth. Another of his arguments was that if you travel up a mountain, it gets colder, as you can see here from this picture of Mount Fuji. Why is that? If you were going away up the mountain, you'd be going further away from the Earth and nearer to the sun. So if the heat was being produced by the sun, it should be the other way around. As you go away from the Earth and go towards the sun, up the mountain, it should get hotter, but it doesn't. To Reverend Francis, that proves that the heat is not coming from the sun, it's coming from the Earth. And this is one of the many diagrams in the book. What he's saying is that there is an electrical force coming from the sun which stimulates heat in the Earth, and the Earth is the one that's generating the heat. And by that means, he can actually explain ice ages and all other things. Well, I gave this book to my wife to read in the summertime, and here you see her laying out in the garden reading his book. So here's my wife in the reading his book, enjoying the illusion that the sun is actually hot and warming her, when, silly woman, it's not. You know, the sun is cold. That great ball up there is not radiating any heat. It's stimulating heat to be created on the Earth. This is the planet Venus. It's a pretty boring place, really, to observe through a telescope. I spent many years in the 60s and 50s observing Venus. You never saw very much on it. It's covered by clouds, and it's a very bright object. At the moment, it's in the morning sky, very low down, so you can't really see it. But there are times when it actually is in the evening sky and very high up, and it is absolutely brilliant. It's the third brightest thing in the sky after the moon and the sun. And it's so bright, it can cast shadows. So you've probably all seen Venus in the evening sky. It does create quite a bit of panic at times when people don't know what it is. They naturally think that it's a flying saucer or a UFO. In fact, back in the 1960s, when there was a lot of UFO sightings going on, this was a drawing that was made by somebody who had said they'd seen this flying saucer up in the sky, flashing lights all going around it. They'd seen portholes along the side, and they could see humanoid aliens looking out of the windows. In fact, what they'd seen here was the planet Venus, just a very bright star in the sort of planet in the sky. There's a whole chapter in my book about UFOs, and if you ever pay the £32 to buy it, you'll see that 98% of sightings of UFOs can easily be explained, often by astronomical means. Carl Sagan and his wife were out at a restaurant, he said, in New York once, and they came out of the restaurant and, oh, he said, look at that, there's Venus up in the sky. It was really bright, white light in the sky. And other people came out and they all started going, oh, what's that? What's that? It must be a UFO. Is it a Russian rocket? Oh, and suddenly this great crowd gathered around them, all going, oh my gosh, we ought to call the police. And Carl Sagan said, my wife and I just quietly walked away and left them to it. I said I observed Venus an awful lot. This is probably about the best drawing I ever made of Venus through any of my telescopes, my homemade telescopes. And you can see there's a little bit of marking up here, a little bit of cloud on there, on the picture. But it's quite remarkable that a great American observer of the late 1800s, Percival Lowell, who actually was the great supporter of the canals of Mars, which we'll come to in a minute, and aliens living on Mars, he observed Venus an awful lot through a fairly substantial telescope. And this is what he would draw. Now, that doesn't look anything like my drawing, and it doesn't look like anything that I've seen drawn by anybody else. And yet he was convinced that Venus had canals. Now, how would he do that? Well, here's Percival Lowell in 1891, observing through this massive refracting telescope. Now, if you look at Venus through a telescope that big, the image of Venus is so bright, it will actually destroy your eye. You know, your retina will be damaged, seriously. It's almost like looking at the sun through a telescope. It's that bad. So what he did, he covered over this huge 2-foot lens at the top of the telescope with a big sheet of card, and he had a little hole cut in it, 2 inches in diameter, and he observed just looking through that little hole to cut down the brightness of the image of Venus. And that was the reason he was seeing those peculiar things. It was only worked out about 3 years ago. A paper was published in an astronomy journal, and they discovered what he was doing. And they said, if you actually take a bit of card and you make a pinhole in it, and you look at a bright light through the pinhole, what you see is all the blood veins and the defects on the retina actually showing up in your eye. By looking through a pinhole, you actually see your own retina. And this is what people do, the opticians do, with an ophthalmoscope. And basically what he'd done, he's working with this at a focal ratio of 200, which is absolutely ridiculous. He turned that telescope into an ophthalmoscope. And the next picture shows a photograph actually taken through an ophthalmoscope of somebody's retina. What an amazing coincidence. Look at that. And he didn't realise that he wasn't observing canals on Venus. He was actually observing his own eyeball. So, very strange character, Percival Lowell. But to be fair to him, ophthalmoscopes hadn't been discovered in those days. Well, up until the 1950s, people knew very, very little about what was going on in Venus. They thought that the clouds, for example, could be water clouds. They thought the temperature of Venus might be quite warm. There could be life on Venus, and there was big arguments going on as to what the surface of Venus was like. Some people thought it was swampy, with dinosaurs and monsters roaming around, like our world was in Carboniferous times. Some people said, no, it's all raging desert, maybe that. Other people had other ideas, like the whole surface is covered in hydrocarbons, like oil. That was another theory in the 1950s. People had absolutely no idea. And this was great because you could speculate about anything. You could even speculate about the life that existed on Venus. And when I was a child in the 1950s and the 40s, I actually believed, like everybody else, there were aliens living on Venus. And there was the evidence. Oh, nostalgia. Yes, the Eagle Comet, first published 1950. I had the very first issue, and I had all the issues from 1 to 100. And one day my mother got fed up with these hanging around the house and threw them all out. They're worth thousands now. Certainly number one is worth a huge amount of money if you've got a good copy of number one. But never mind, you don't know these things, do you? There could have been a Mekon flying around on Venus. There could have been treens. The day on Venus was 25 hours, it was believed. And these treens were modified humans, as far as I remember. And they had these glands inserted into their heads to get them used to this different day cycle. And the Mekon, oh dear, it was just lovely, really. But it says, after their successful attack on the Red Moon, Dan and his friends crash-landed their battered spacecraft onto the torrid wastes of Mercury, only to be taken prisoner by the strange rock-like inhabitants of the mystery planet, meanwhile in another part of the planet. Oh, I loved it. And of course, in the Eagle Comet, on the middle pages, you've got these huge detailed cutaways, didn't you, of locomotives and aircraft and things like that. It was amazing. But the thing in the 1950s was, it was possible. Nobody knew what was going on under the clouds of Venus. Anything could have been going on down there. In the 1950s, late 1940s, early 1950s, though, a Venusian did apparently come to the Earth. He's on the right, and his name's Valiant Thor. Isn't it wonderful that a person could come from Venus with a name like that? Valiant Thor. Just made for the job, really, isn't it? And the lady on the left is his girlfriend, called Jill, or some people say Teal, T-E-E-L. And he arrived, and he started taking conferences with President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon. And apparently he was here for about 3 years, and he was given free access to the White House to tell the President Eisenhower all about Venus and how lovely it was and how they'd stopped having wars and how they'd controlled the climate and this is what you need to do. And this went on for about 3 years, I suppose. The exploits of Valiant Thor were all documented in a book by a chap called George Hurd, and he describes Valiant Thor's meeting with Eisenhower and the things that were discussed. And Hurd himself was taken on trips, apparently, on Valiant Thor's spacecraft, his flying saucer. And he described, I've read the book, and the thing that sticks in my mind most is the trouble he had using the flying saucer's toilet. And in fact, I'm going to go, if next time I give my history of the laboratory, I'm going to include this. Because apparently George Hurd was sitting there in the UFO, and he'd finished doing what he needed to do, and he'd looked for the toilet paper, and there wasn't any. We've all had that experience, haven't we? I know I have. And so telepathically, he got in control with Valiant Thor, who was on another part of the UFO, and said, hey, I've got a bit of a problem here, no toilet paper. Do not worry, came back the message. There are three buttons on your right. Press the top one, then the next one, and then the bottom one. So he pressed the top one, and this strange ray came out of the toilet bowl and crystallized all the matter that was actually not needed anymore. And then he pressed the second button, and he got a spray of water all over his buttocks. And the third one, he got a nice warming air blowing over it. Apart from the first one, it's very much like a modern Japanese toilet, I think, by the sound of it. So he was quite pleased with this, and he went out. But he was even more surprised when he went out, and he found Jill, or Teal, or whatever her name was, with a little box saying, "Oh, these are your crystallised faeces. Would you like them?" And I thought, that would be absolutely wonderful as a paperweight, wouldn't it, in the office? What a talking point. I used to work at AUWE Bincleaves, and I worked with a guy there who had this very interesting paperweight. It was a huge coiled lump of wax which he'd got out of his ear, and he'd cast it into acrylic, into a paperweight. It's rather like Shrek, you know, when Shrek pulls out a candle from his ear. But anyway, I'm wandering. Anyway, so if you ever get abducted by an alien spacecraft, you know now how to use the toilet. The trouble was that round about the mid-1950s and early 60s, they started to send spacecraft to Venus, and eventually one of the Russian spacecraft managed to land on the surface of Venus. And it was a bit of a shock because they discovered that the clouds weren't water, they were made of sulfuric acid droplets. The pressure of the atmosphere was about 90 times greater than the Earth. The atmosphere was almost completely carbon dioxide. Obviously, Venus has had a runaway greenhouse effect at some time, which is what we're going to get eventually. And so the temperature at the surface of Venus was about 500 degrees centigrade. Well, when these discoveries were made, that was about the time that Valiant 4 vanished. and people did wonder how he managed to survive looking like that. It was said, George Heard said, though, that he had amazing clothes. Although his clothes looked typically American, they tested them and they were unable even to snag them. And they actually, on his jacket, they actually used a drill bit from an oil exploration equipment to try and get into this suit and make some damage to the threads. But no, his suit was completely indestructible. And that's probably why he survived all this sulfuric acid and high temperatures on Venus. But when I say he disappeared, apparently there was a UFO conference in about 1955, 56, 57, where him and Teal, or Jill, whatever her name was, were sitting on the front row, and they suddenly just shimmered and vanished. They went. That was it. They'd gone. They were never seen again. Very strange. Right, moving out to the Earth. People have had very strange ideas about the Earth over the years. One of the great puzzles, one of the things that Sir Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet fame worried about, was the magnetic field of the Earth. He was a great fan of trying to measure the magnetic field. And he actually took two long trips all the way through the Atlantic as the captain of a Royal Navy frigate, the HMS Paramore. This was in the late 1700s. He wasn't a qualified sailor or anything like that, but he was such an illustrious astronomer. They said, "Oh, yeah, you can take those ships," you know. And the crew mutinied twice because they said he was such a disaster as a captain. He didn't know anything about sailing ships. But nevertheless, Halley went around the world and he plotted the magnetic field of the Earth, its strength and the direction in which it pointed. And he couldn't make any sense of this at all. In fact, people have been trying to make sense of the Earth's magnetic field for a very long time. In medieval times, they believed that at the north and south poles, there were huge mountains sticking out of the sea, which were made of lodestone. And lodestone is a magnetic ore of iron. In fact, the Chinese, over 1,000 years ago, they made magnetic compasses using lodestone, long before we'd done that sort of thing in the West. And so there's a medieval picture showing lodestone. But the magnetic fields don't just stick in one place, they move around. The North Pole, for example, moves around quite a bit. And you probably believe, because you were told at school, that the North Magnetic Pole is somewhere in North Canada. Well, it's not. It's moved away from there. This is where the North Pole was in 1590, the North Magnetic Pole, and then it moved up there till about 1832, back there 1730, and then it rattled off down here. This is all North Canada, Ellesmere Island and so on. But since about the 1904, it's been heading off in this direction. And it's now somewhere up here, 2015, 2020, that's where they estimate it's going to be. The magnetic North Pole of the Earth now is no longer in Canada, it's somewhere north of the Bering Straits, you know, the Aleutian Islands run between Siberia and Alaska. It's somewhere up there. It's nowhere near Canada anymore. It's moving at a hell of a rate, and nobody knows why. It's a great mystery. One of the greatest mysteries about geology is why the Earth's magnetic pole has suddenly started over the last 20, 30, 40 years to move so quickly. Also,
It's going to reverse.
It's going to reverse. It's also weakened by more than 10% over the last 200 years. It's heading for a zero. We're going to lose our magnetic field, and that would be a disaster. But I'm not going to worry about that personally. But Halley knew all about these movements, and the only way he could explain this was to assume that the Earth was hollow, and that there was a solid inner. This is a painting of Halley showing his theory. So the Earth has a solid ball inside it, and it has three concentric spheres or shells going round it, and we live on the outer one. And he said it's because the movement of these shells, which are all magnetic, it's so complicated that this is why the Earth's magnetic field is changing with time and changing in direction. But he went even further than this. He said that all these inner shells were inhabited, and each one had its own sun to illuminate it, so that the inhabitants beneath our feet on these shells beneath us, all these moving shells, could actually survive. And he believed that there was a hole at the North Pole where you could get access into the Earth to go and visit these people. And when one of the little suns that goes round inside the Earth happens to go under the hole of the North Pole, it shines up out, and that's what causes the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis. It all fits, doesn't it? These days, all these sort of theories are more popular than they have ever been. If you type hollow Earth into Google, you get 7 million results come up. It's everywhere. Ideas about the Earth being hollow, being flat. You just can't get away from it. This is just one thing I got off the internet a couple of weeks ago, and you can see the theory here that the Earth is hollow. There are continents on the inside of the shell on which we live, which are quite different to the continents on the outside, and you can see this here. There's America, obviously, but there are continents here which are unlike ours, and there are creatures living in there, and there's an inner sun. Now, Halley believed that there was a solid globe with two more shells. So he was obviously wrong, because this is quite clearly the sensible option, isn't it? Just one shell and one inner sun. And you've still got a hole at the North Pole. What evidence is there for a hole at the North Pole? It's actually very powerful. There are real photographs out there of a huge hole at the North Pole. And this is where you get access to all the alien life forms that are living inside the Earth. You say, well, okay, I flew last summer from England out to Los Angeles, and they told us we were going over the North Pole. And all the people who believe it say, ha-ha, no, they told you that, but you didn't really go over the North Pole. There is a secret directive to all airlines on Earth never to go anywhere near the North Pole so that people can't see the hole. But when you've got photographs like that, you don't need to, you know, don't need to worry. It's there, isn't it, obviously. The theory of a hollow Earth is actually goes back a long way. Edmund Halley believed it in the late 1700s, and you've got encyclopedias which show pictures like this. In this case, though, this is a little bit different. This is a hollow Earth, and we live on the inside of the shell. You think, well, how's that possible? So the theory here is that the entire universe exists inside the Earth, and what we live on is the inside of that hollow sphere, and there are all the planets and things going around inside it. And that theory has been around for a very long time. In fact, there was a guy called George Symes in about the 1860s in America who decided he wanted to have an expedition to the North Pole to actually find the hole and get through and see everything that was going on inside the Earth. And he went to the president, Quincy Adams, and Congress actually said, yeah, fine, we'll fund all this. We'll fund you an expedition to go to the North Pole, find this hole, go down into the centre of the Earth and find all these aliens and learn what they're doing. Unfortunately, Quincy Adams was voted out at the next election, and the new president who came in was a bit more sensible and cancelled the whole idea. So that exhibition never happened. But the idea of a hollow Earth was very popular in the 1930s. And in fact, in the city of Magdeburg in Germany, the town council decided that the Earth really was hollow in the sense that we're living on the inside of a sphere, and all the geology that we learn is all on the outside. And they funded some German rocket scientists to build rockets which could be fired straight up in the sky to crash land in Australia. And they paid them an awful lot of money. And one of those rocket scientists was a guy called Wernher von Braun. You may have heard of him. He bombed our chippy, actually. Yeah. Never forgiven him for that. He was the guy who designed all the V1, V2 rockets during the war. I've got a book up there called The Exploration of Mars, and he actually wrote that book, bless him. One of the worst Nazis to ever survive the war, actually, he was. But could this actually work inside out? Well, yes, it could. Can you imagine yourself living on the surface of a sphere like that, but you're on the inside? Is it possible that the laws of physics could be changed so that that gives the illusion of living on the outside of the Earth? And yes, it can. And when I was a student at university in the 50s, just as a little exercise, I decided to work out simple things like what would it be like to live on the inside of a sphere like that? And I worked out that if light travelled on circles, and if infinity was that little white spot in the middle, and if the speed of light was proportional to the distance from infinity, you couldn't tell the difference between living in a world like that and living in the world we live in. Sounds strange, but it's just a simple mathematical transformation of coordinates, does it? So if you imagine you're on the inside of one of these hollow earths like this, and you're an observer at point A, then this circle is your horizon. Because you see, the light is coming from infinity. It's going on an arc of a semicircle like that, round there, and it's just grazing the circle. So this light following that path would be the light that you see coming along the horizon. That light actually curves up faster away from the Earth than the Earth's surface curves up. And so it would appear that ships would go over the horizon, but they're not. They're actually going up the inside of the hollow Earth, but the light is curving quicker. And so they appear to be going over the horizon. You have to think about this a bit. But in the 1990s, Martin Gardner, who you may have heard of, for many decades he wrote articles in Scientific American, he actually had a go at the same thing that I'd had a go on and came to the same conclusion. He said you could live on the inside of a hollow earth like that with Australia directly above you, and you could not tell the difference if the laws of physics were changed in just certain ways. So maybe it's all true. It's certainly still believed now. I found this on the internet. You don't have to search very hard to find these things. Jupiter is a glass ball inside the concave Earth. So there we've got the inside of the sphere, the hollow sphere. Here you've got the continents that we're familiar with. I think that's Scandinavia and everything around there. And there's Jupiter, which is a glass painted ball. I was walking with my wife and a stepson and so on down near Plymouth in the summer. And we were doing the Southwest Coastal Path, and we'd gone several miles, and we came to this little beach where there were some concrete steps going down. Nobody else around, miles from anywhere, and somebody had put this sticker on one of the iron posts holding up the handrail for the concrete steps. The Earth is flat. We live on a flat, motionless plane. Research flat Earth. And there are people going around putting these stickers all round towns and countryside and everything else. The Flat Earth Society is thriving more than it ever has. You may have seen on Have I Got News For You 2 weeks ago, it featured a guy in America who built this rocket, which he was going to ride in, to go up and prove that the Earth was flat. Unfortunately, he didn't have the money available, and the rocket wasn't a great success, so he hadn't actually succeeded. But I also discovered that there's a rapper in America called B.O.B., and he's crowdfunding to get $250,000 together to actually send a rocket up to take photographs to prove that the Earth is flat. So far, he's raised $650. So that's not to be sneezed at, though, is it? I mean, just to go on the internet and say, please give me money to prove that the Earth's flat, and people give you $650. So there we are. You type flat Earth into Google and you get 12 million hits. It's amazing how many people believe that the Earth is flat. And there was somebody on television the other day saying, oh, it's definitely flat. You know, if you stand on a hill, like on an island at sea, and you look round, the horizon doesn't bend away. It's a flat line going round like this. And how can you disprove that the Earth's round to people like that? Now, you're not going to believe this, but when I was at school in the late 40s, early 1950s, I was taught that the Earth was actually a tetrahedron at one stage in its existence, and it was like this. The argument behind this was that all the great land masses are opposite oceans. So North America's opposite Indian Ocean, and so on. Europe is opposite the Pacific, and so on. It's true. If you look at a globe, the great land masses are opposite oceans. Also, most of the continents and most of the oceans are triangular in shape. And again, you can see that in this tetrahedron. So the idea was that was once, for some reason, a tetrahedron, but by erosion of the atmosphere and so on, the edges have been worn away, and now it's round, but it's left that general shape. This, of course, is a load of nonsense, because when I was at school, we weren't taught about plate tectonics and continental drift, because although it was known, it was discredited at that time. But we now know that continental drift has been moving all the continents around for hundreds or even thousands of millions of years, so there is no proof in this. But it would be rather nice if the Earth had been a tetrahedron at one stage, I think. Going out to the moon now, I showed this picture at the beginning. In 1834, the great Sir John Herschel, son of William Herschel, took a huge telescope to South Africa, and he spent about 4 or 5 years down there observing and plotting all the stars in the southern sky, which couldn't be seen from the northern hemisphere. Now, communications between South Africa and America in the 1830s was, of course, painfully slow, weeks to get messages backwards and forwards. And so a reporter on a newspaper appropriately called The Sun, but it was actually the Baltimore Sun, he decided he was going to perpetrate a hoax. And he started publishing articles about what Sir John Herschel was seeing through his telescope in South Africa. He said, "This is an amazing telescope. The lens weighs 7 tons, and it can magnify 42,000 times. It's so powerful, he can see creatures walking and existing on the surface of the moon." And he started publishing drawings like this. And he said, "There are humanoids who fly around like bat wings. You've got unicorns, there's a unicorn down there, and you've got these strange ibis-like birds. And the surface of the moon is really luxuriant. There are palm trees, there are waterfalls." I'm hoping that the publisher will put this on the cover of my astronomy book, actually. I think it would be a selling point. The fact that the paper was called The Sun, I think, also explains the fact that the alien females are naked and showing their breasts. And also, if you look closely, you can actually see a little bit of pubic hair there as well. You definitely can down here, but you'd have to come up to the screen to see that. So, yeah, The Sun, it's got a bit of a reputation, hasn't it? Whichever newspaper called The Sun, they've got to have a few bare boobs out. Anyway, this went on for quite a while, and apparently the circulation of the newspaper increased by a factor of 6 while this was going on. But the hoax sort of went on so long that eventually the reporter got tired of it, and he said, "Oh, there's been a terrible accident. John Herschel left this telescope pointing at the sun, and as a result, it set fire to the observatory, and the whole thing's been destroyed, so you won't get any more reports from me." Well, when John Herschel came back to Britain and he heard about this, he actually thought it was very funny, you know, good for him. He said, "Oh, I really enjoyed it." He said, "You've read all the articles and I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, there are no creatures like that on the moon." There's one of the alien humanoids that apparently was seen there. In the 1950s, when I started doing astronomy with my little homemade telescopes, there was a lot of fuss about an apparent bridge on the moon. And this guy didn't see it. The guy who saw it was an American called O'Neill. But this guy is H.P. Wilkins. And H.P. Wilkins in the 50s, he spent his life drawing the moon, the details of the moon, and he produced this vast map, and he got minute details. Now, in 1960, that was published as a book, and I have a copy at the back, and you're welcome to browse and see the incredible detail where the map has been split up into pages. But O'Neill claimed in a little part of the moon just there, which I've marked with an orange arrow in the atlas, there was a bridge. And this is a drawing of the bridge. This bridge, apparently, is 12 miles from side to side and rises 5,000 feet above the surface of the moon. And that's where it is. Wow. And Wilkins, who was a great believer in flying saucers, actually went on the radio and said, "Yes, there's no question. This is an alien bridge. It's been built by aliens. No question about it. There are aliens on the moon." Well, I said, I made some observations myself of this. I didn't actually see the bridge. This is the area where the bridge is supposed to be. The bridge is supposed to go from that lot of mountains across to that lot of mountains. And as you can see, there's a mountain pass where the lava has flowed through in billions of years ago. But there's no bridge. Nobody has ever seen the bridge since. But the belief that there are aliens on the moon is widespread, absolutely widespread. I'm not going to go into more details of that. Mars, that's what Mars looks like when you get up there with a spacecraft. No canals. Despite that, Percival Lowell, he who saw his own retina, he discovered absolutely hundreds of canals and oases on Mars and mapped them all in great detail. A lot of people didn't see these, but a lot of people did. So it's all a bit weird. Why should some astronomers see things and other astronomers not? It's because of a thing called logical science, which is the study of things that don't exist. There are things like the canals of Mars. People saw them, lots of people saw them. They don't exist. Markings on Mercury, which don't exist. The canals on Venus, which we've just seen, don't exist. Cold fusion, N-rays, astrology, many, many things like this. Whole sciences have been built up around things which don't exist. I'm not going to talk any more about this because in 1990 I had an article published in New Scientist about pathological science. Pathological science, people studying things that don't exist. But the canals on Mars were a great popular thing in the 1950s, 1960s. There was a great artist called Chesley Bonstil, and he painted pictures in the 1940s, 1950s of what the scenes would look like from the other planets and the moons of the planets. And he went to great trouble to make these as accurate as possible. And in the book, The Exploration of Mars, which was published in 1952, which is up there, a lot of his paintings are in there. Just flick through the book and have a look. Absolutely amazing. I've left it open, actually, at one of his big two-page spreads showing what he thought Mars was like. And this is what he thought Mars was like. And it's what everybody really thought Mars was like. You're standing on the North Polar ice cap and you're looking south and there are the canals. But although Percival Lowell thought the canals were actually built by aliens to bring water down as the polar ice caps melted, the majority of people thought perhaps they're just cracks or something like that, you know. But the existence of the canals of Mars, that was never doubted. There were canals on Mars. And there were Martians. I was given an astronomy book for children in 1953, the year of the coronation. And this is a picture from the book, and I've got the book at the back there, open at this page. And this is what the author of the book was saying the Martians could look like. Yeah. They're millions of years ahead of us, so their brains are like huge because of the development. But machines do all the work, and so their bodies have just atrophied away until all they've got is a little bit of tentacles to move them around like this. And that picture used to scare the wits out of me. I was a very sensitive child. And the thought that there were creatures like that on Mars really, really scared the willies out of me, I have to admit. But that's what people thought in the 1950s. It was all rubbish. However, in 1996, you may remember, they thought they'd found a fossil bacteria in a meteorite that had come from Mars. Millions of years ago, some huge rock asteroid had hit Mars and blown debris into space, and some of this debris had actually come to Earth and landed on the Antarctic ice sheets. And when they cut it open, they thought they found this bacterium, fossilised bacterium. And everybody was very excited. It was the front news of the papers, you may remember it. There's some doubt about this now. The first doubt was that bacterium is extremely small. It's about 100 times smaller than any Earth bacterium. And it's very difficult to see how a live bacterium of any sort could exist at that size. But now they believe that's actually something created by a calcite deposit or a crystal, which is a great shame, really. But you still get lots of people believing in life on Mars. This is the famous face on Mars, which everybody said, oh, it's been carved by an ancient Mars civilization to tell us that they're there. Well, no. When NASA sent other spacecraft to have a look at this, it turned out just to be what's called a mesa, which is like Table Mountain. It's just a flat rock sticking up out of there. And it just happened that when the sun was shining in the right direction, it looked like a face. But when the sun shines in other direction, it's not a face. This is a close-up photograph taken on Mars. It's like a monolith. It's quite tall. NASA says that it's a boulder. The conspiracy theorists reckon it's a proper monolith put there by aliens. And this one was discovered on a Mars Explorer photograph, actually on one of the moons of Mars called Phobos. And it's quite big. I think it's about 25 foot in width and something like 200 feet in height, something like that. And it's people said, wow, that's exactly like the monolith from the film 2001, isn't it? Has an alien civilization actually put that thing there for us to find, go and explore it, and discover that there really are aliens? You know, perhaps it's covered in alien writing. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there which is a bit spooky. Right, Jupiter. Not going to say a lot about Jupiter. Johannes Kepler, who was a great student of Tycho Brahe's, he was very, very religious, and he believed that the universe was created by God with a great purpose, that there was nothing redundant in the universe. And he noted that we have one moon, and Jupiter has four big moons, and he pondered as to why God would do this. And he said, well, the moon on the Earth is there to supply light after sunset during the night, so that we can carry on our lives and go hunting and go sailing and things like that under moonlight. Because Jupiter's a lot further away from the sun than we are, therefore God has given Jupiter four big moons. And also, moons are very useful for sailors when they're navigating their way around the planet. And so he reasoned that Jupiter must be covered in large oceans, and there must be huge armadas of ships trading and travelling around all over Jupiter, using the four moons that God has provided for them to be able to see where they are when the sun's not in the sky, and also to be able to navigate accurately. And he also argued that, of course, all these sailing ships would need lots of sails and rope, and to get all this rope, there must be lots of hemp. And so he argued that Jupiter was mostly covered by oceans, but there was also a lot of land where they had forests of hemp. So when you've got all these sailors and a lot of hemp, it must be quite an interesting place to go, I would think. One of the Pioneer probes went into space and had this plaque attached to it. It went to Jupiter, and then it travelled on and is now going through interstellar space. And this plaque was put on to tell any aliens that found it what we are like, and also where it came from. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the stuff on the left, because, like everybody else, I'm interested in the stuff on the right. And I'm going to read a bit from my book now, just to tell you how difficult it is to send messages into space. It was designed by Carl and Linda Sagan, I should say. It was initially planned that the two figures would be holding hands to show that they were two versions of the same species. However, that was ruled out for fear that aliens might think that humans came in one variety, consisting of two large blobs joined thin tendril. So the humans were shown making no contact. The man's arm was raised. This was arranged to show the opposable thumb and fingers and multiple flexible arm joints, which have been so important as our in our technological development. The upraised arm is also seen on Earth as a sign of greeting, but this might on a distant planet be a sign of anger and aggression. It could be interpreted as informing the aliens that the creatures who sent the probe are coming to invade their planet. In the end, it was decided to keep the upraised arm. Why is it that the male is making the gesture and not the female? Why is there an asymmetry in the roles of the males and the females? This is the 1970s, remember? Why didn't they make both have an upraised arm? A lot of people were very unhappy about this depiction of apparent subjugation of female humans. It was intended that the human figures would look pan-racial. No easy task given the wide range of human appearances worldwide. The final figures appeared Caucasian, like us. In the original drawing, the man was drawn with an Afro haircut, but was later changed to a Mediterranean-style curly hair in the final engraving. Linda Sagan intended to show both the man and the woman as having brown hair, but as the hair was only outlined, this made the hair appear blonde instead, another unintended Caucasian feature that upset a large number of people, as you can imagine. They're looking awfully European, aren't they, and American. Linda Sagan decided to make the figures nude to make more anatomically educational for the extraterrestrials. It was thought that showing humans with clothes might confuse aliens who would think that humans had a natural, loose body covering that had evolved to protect them in the way that tortoises wear a shell. This nudity was viewed as pornographic by a lot of the American media. That is actually how it was depicted in a lot of American newspapers. Rather oddly, there was little comment on the lack of pubic hair in the drawing and the fact that the female's genitalia had been completely ignored. As you can see, she has not been drawn complete. The aliens puzzling over this message might have guessed that the dangly thing in the man's groin had something to do with reproduction, but where on earth did the man put this strange floppy-looking device? The only female orifices drawn are on her face. Thus, the aliens might conclude that humans engage in sexual reproduction by external means, such as some amphibians and fish do on Earth, where the female lays eggs and the male then comes along and fertilises them. Well, you can see how difficult it is to communicate with aliens. At that stage, Carl Sagan and Linda said, oh, what not? We're going to send it anyway, whether you like it or not. So communicating with aliens is a bit of a problem. Saturn's rings. You've seen wonderful pictures coming back from Cassini, haven't you? But did you know that in the 1700s, a monk wrote a treatise claiming that the ring on Saturn is actually Jesus' foreskin? Think about that for a moment. The foreskin of Jesus was the only part of him that would have been left on earth after he was resurrected. In the 17th century, a monk, Leo Atelius, wrote a title for a book which is titled A Discussion of the Foreskin of Our Lord Jesus Christ, wherein he claimed that the holy foreskin ascended to heaven with Jesus and became the ring around Saturn. Unsurprisingly, this is not the current scientific theory explaining the origin of Saturn's ring. It seems more pertinent to inquire which of Jesus' foreskins might have become the ring of Saturn, because it has been claimed that there is no less than 12 churches and abbeys in France, Germany and Belgium and Italy which at all at the same time claim to have Jesus' foreskin on display. It's also noted in the book that St. John the Baptist's head is also claimed to have been held in the 1500s in three abbeys, so he obviously had three heads. And some people think that he might have had as many as 16 on at any one time. St. Brigitta, who was a 14th century Swedish nun, had a vision in which she chewed up and swallowed the holy foreskin. So great, she said, was the sweetness of swallowing of this membrane that she felt a sweet transformation in all her members and the muscles of her members. Right, okay, good. Let's move rapidly on through the solar system. These are just curious things, I suppose. The left-hand side is a picture of one of the moons of Saturn called Mimas. It was discovered by Sir William Herschel. And the big crater that you see on it, which is this massive thing here, is named Herschel in his honour. And this thing over here is the Star Wars Death Star, as you probably realise. The curious resemblance to this is that the Death Star actually appeared in film about 4 years before this photograph was taken. So that is just a pure coincidence. It's not as if George Lucas designed the Death Star to look like Mimas. We didn't know what Mimas looked like when that was actually built. Saturn has a moon called Iapetus, and this is a very curious moon because as it goes round Saturn, it's very bright and then it disappears, and then it's very bright and disappears. And this puzzled people for a long, long time. And it wasn't until a spacecraft went and visited, they discovered what was going on. One half of Iapetus is bright, which is the left-hand side, obviously, and the right-hand side is completely black. It's covered with like a soot material all over the surface. And the difference in brightness is about a factor of 10 to 1. So it's like a sort of yin-yang moon. Half of it is bright and half of it is black. Very, very curious. There is a reason for this, but I won't go into it in the interest of time. Buy the book. One curious thing about Iapetus is that it's shaped like a walnut. It has this ridge which runs right the way round it, like a girdle. And it doesn't look very significant there, but the height of those mountains is twice as high as Mount Everest. So it really is quite a spectacular moon. And none of this was known, of course, before spacecraft went up there and had a look. Another moon that we've got out there going around Uranus is Miranda. And this is a very odd one. You've probably seen photographs of these on television as well. And what people think happened here is that the original moon was hit by something extremely large and smashed to pieces. And the pieces then all went off and circled round the sun. And over the course of millions or billions of years, all these pieces came together again. So it's like a sort of jigsaw that's been done rather badly. So it's a moon, they think, which has been smashed into pieces. And then it's all come back together and making this very, very odd-looking moon. Very strange thing. What about that one? This is a moon of Saturn called Pan. It's very small, and I call it the ravioli moon. And I called it that because if you look very carefully, you can see the marks of a giant fork which have been scraping over it. But of course, the UFO conspiracy theorists say, oh, wow, you know, that looks exactly like a flying saucer. It's a very ancient flying saucer that's out there in space and been battered around a bit. But what this very thin girdle going round it is, nobody knows. They have no idea why it's that shape. Very odd. In the 1960s, in Spain, in a recreation park, it was reported that about 60 or 70 people saw a flying saucer coming across, and it hovered over the recreation field and it tilted to show this marking on the bottom. Well, that's the astrological symbol for the planet Uranus, and it started a huge cult of people who believe that aliens are coming from the planet Uranus in flying saucers and visiting the Earth. And a lot of people have claimed to make telepathic contact with the pilots of these things. Well, not long after this photograph was taken, the photograph was sent to NASA for analysis, and when they put it through a computer, One thing they discovered was a string holding the flying saucer up, which you can't see in the original photograph. And they were also able to show that the flying saucer was no more than 6 inches in diameter. So it was obviously a disc the size of a dinner plate being held up with a string in front of the camera. But that hasn't stopped the cult of everybody, or people believing that flying saucers come from the planet Uranus. Comets cause great fear and consternation whenever they're coming around through the sky. This is an etching from a magazine in 1857 showing a comet breaking the Earth apart, and everybody was absolutely horrified, and a lot of them still are. And you can look at the sun up there, sneering. I rather like that face on there. He's looking at that, you know, another planet gone, who cares? Yeah. But this fear of comets goes back a very long way, and certainly this medieval drawing shows, it's supposed to be a drawing of a comet. What you actually have there is a hand holding a dagger up in the clouds, and surrounding the dagger you have severed heads with blood gushing out of the severed heads, and lots of hatchets and machetes and all sorts of things going round it. And that's people were so scared of comets, that's what they thought they actually looked like. It's like people who think they look at Venus and think they're seeing a flying saucer. And of course, Halley's Comet appeared in the sky at the Battle of Hastings. Every time a comet appeared, and this is in Shakespeare's plays, quite well known, every time a comet appeared, then they reckoned that somebody was going to die, an emperor or king or something like that. Unfortunately, nobody seemed to know who it was. When it appeared at the Battle of Hastings, some were saying, you know, William was going to die, and some were saying Harold's going to die. In fact, it was Harold who got it in the eye in the end. But they all blamed the comet anyway. And sometimes they would blame the comet even tens of years after the comet had actually appeared. This is an etching from the 1570s, and this is probably quite lifelike. Some comets are truly spectacular. We haven't had one like this in our lifetime, but if one ever appears, this is what it would look like. It's called a Crookes sun-grazing comet, and these things come very close to the Earth, and they get very close to the sun, and usually they hit the sun and disappear into it. But you can imagine the terror that would cause with people. This is actually a comet. This is Hale-Bopp, which was around not so long ago. There is the tragic story here of the Heaven's Gate cult who committed suicide and were hoping to be transported up to a UFO which was hiding behind Hale-Bopp. 59 people actually committed suicide over a period of 3 days. So it's all very sad. It just shows even in modern times that people take comets very, very seriously. This is the unpronounceable named comet that Rosetta, the European Space Agency spacecraft Rosetta, went to, and it dropped a little lander called Philae onto the surface. And that's what a comet is like when it hasn't got a tail coming out of it. It's really quite extraordinary. But there's a great conspiracy theory going on as to why would the European Space Agency spend so many millions of euros to send a spacecraft up to this little insignificant comet when they could go somewhere else. And the theory is that there are radio signals being received from this comet, which are being held top secret, so nobody should know about it, and they sent the space probe up there to try and find the aliens on the comet that was sending out these signals. Of course, ESA says this is all rubbish. Well, they would, wouldn't they? You know, it's all conspiracy. We're all being governed by lizard men. The photographs that have appeared on the internet, available on the internet, are extremely detailed, extremely high resolution. And this is one photograph which I found which purports to show possibly an alien base. This is a very much blown up part of the previous image, and you notice a little white speck in the middle there. If you zoom into that, people claim that that is a flying saucer hovering over the surface of the comet, and you can see that it's casting a shadow, but there's a gap between the flying saucer and the shadow, and nobody can explain that. Spooky or what? Right, this is the largest telescope in the world, or it will be when it's finished. It's being built out in Peru, and they just started all the foundations for it. It's called, and rather unimaginatively, the Extremely Large Telescope. And the main mirror is 39 metres in diameter, and you see there two astronomers to give the scale of how big this telescope is going to be when it's completed. And if you're going to do anything really serious in astronomy, studying the universe, you need to gather an awful lot of light. And this is why they make these mirrors bigger and bigger and bigger, absolutely gigantic. However, Mr. Bradbury, who appears in the book Can You Speak Venusian, he knew that you had to get a lot of light in, but he had a different approach to it. He actually built this telescope, which he said could perform better than any of the telescopes that the astronomers had. The reason that his telescope is so powerful, that he's got lots of lenses in it, but he puts all the lenses one behind the other in an aluminium tube. Now imagine what that must look like when you look through that. Patrick Moore, who looked through it with a straight face, said, "It's very difficult to see anything at all through that." But Mr. Bradbury made amazing discoveries with this. He discovered, for example, the true structure of the universe. And it's like this. The Earth is flat in the middle, and it's surrounded by concentric shells, some of which are made of iron. You have a magnetic space, a pure vacuum, a sub-semi vacuum, and an ionosphere. And all the stars and planets and the moon move on the bound, are stuck on this boundary, which is between the two outer concentric areas. It's an interesting model, but it's not the model that's generally accepted at the moment by astronomers. There's a Mr. Shenton, who was a chiropodist living in Dover. He had a completely different idea, and he mocked this model, saying, no, it's not at all like that. What the universe is really like is that the Earth and the Sun are the only bodies in the universe, and all these are contained in a sort of a reflecting bag, you know, rather like a helium balloon, but on the inside, if you can imagine that. And what we think of the stars and the planets are simply the light from the sun reflecting and bouncing, perhaps several times, off this reflecting outer surface, which he calls infinity. So in theory, you could actually travel to infinity, cut a hole in it, and stick your head through and see what's on the other side, which is an interesting concept. And I think I'm going to start a crowdfunding exercise for that and see how much money I can raise. If I can get £1,000, I'll be quite happy. To send a spacecraft to infinity and go beyond. Buzz Lightyear, infinity and beyond. So that's Samuel Shenton's universe. And he explains quite a lot about this. He says, well, you know, why do the stars have different colours? Well, if the light's reflecting off a bit of this infinity, which is coloured, it will pick up that colour. So some stars like Aldebaran will be red, some stars like Rigel will be white, and so on. It all depends where the light from the sun is bouncing off this in a shape like that. Right, that actually brings me to the end of the talk.